Good evening, everyone. Thank you for your patience. We are learning how to do this with unexpected turns of Zoom and Wi-Fi. But this is, you know, this is how we'll learn to do it, all going well in the coming weeks and for Loon Lake. So we are all part of this great experiment. So I'm happy to see you back, and maybe some just joining us. I'm just going to switch to page 2 so I can see a few more. Oh, wonderful. Okay, well, day two of our practice period. Kay has the great privilege and honor of being the first Shuso ever to be installed on Zoom and to be functioning. And one thing we haven't announced yet is one thing that the Shuso gives, the Shuso actually has more to do in our practice periods than a Shuso would at even Tassajara, the San Francisco Zen Center Monastery. Although there they get to turn the compost. Here the Shuso gets to clean the washrooms, which is an extra important given our circumstances. The Shuso gives a few talks and a kind of Dharma seminar, which Kay will be doing Sunday mornings. And the Shuso also has tea with practice period participants. And that pretty much is probably going to be all on Zoom. We'll work out the details. And so people meet with the Shuso in groups of 2 or 3, often, usually in groups. So we will devise a system for this, a sign-up system, which will be announced by email. So stay tuned for that. This is a work in progress. So the paramitas. First one is generosity. That's the one we'll be looking at this coming week. It's the one to start with because it opens the heart, tenderizes the heart. If I were to ask you to tell me a story about your first experience of generosity, I wonder what it would be. Go back as far as you can, even to childhood. Sorry, this is slipping. For most of us, it would be an experience of receiving generosity. Probably would be our first, and most of us can't remember being fed at the breast or with a bottle. Can anybody remember that? I can't. Yeah, a few people can. Yeah. But most of us might have a feeling, a kind of feeling of warmth, connection, even bliss. Or maybe not, you know, if we had a mother who was anxious or depressed. Hard to know. What I do remember, though, is my mom reading stories to my little sister and me, and singing to us at bedtime. And it had that feeling. In later years, things got more complicated, by complicated with resentment, withholding. And maybe that's why I still love lullabies, the feeling of being sung to. This is the one I loved the most. Hush-a-bye, my little owlet, in your mossy swaying nest, with thy little woodland sisters, close thine eyes and take thy rest. To it, I loved being her little owlet. I also remember the warmth and satisfaction of giving. Can you remember your first experience of giving a gift that you chose yourself, maybe you bought with your own money? For me, it was going to the hardware store, little town hardware store with my dad, and I bought for my brother and sister one of those flying saucers that you slide on the snow with. It was aluminum rather than plastic in those days. And it was just the best present. They loved it. We had so much fun with that thing for years, and when it got so scratched and dented it was finally retired, it became a bird bath in our backyard, and we got to watch the birds splashing in it and bathing in it. And it just brought so much happiness. And I chose it, right? You know, like, it means a lot when you get to do that as a little kid. And it was with my, you know, my saved up little quarters and dimes and, you know, I don't know what we got for allowance. Was it, you know, maybe it was 50 cents at some point. That was a big deal. And every year at Christmas, my grandparents would give us an envelope with a crisp, brand new $10 bill. That was like a big deal. Another era. And that same year, I got my mom at the same hardware store, a stoneware pie dish. And my mom was a really good pie baker. Apple, cherry, peach, blueberry, pumpkin. And so that gift kept giving for many years. Many, many years. Decades. When we're children, we don't even necessarily know that word generosity. But we know the feeling of it, of receiving it and giving it, if we're fortunate. And later we might learn a word to call it. And then we might learn that it's a quality we're supposed to have. And if we don't, we're really selfish and bad. We learn to be ashamed. And I learned that too. Maybe it happened something like that in human evolution. Maybe there was a feeling, a kind of felt sense of warmth and connection, and a sensory input to go with it, sounds, smells. Or maybe there was a kind of mother image, and then we gave it a name, and then maybe we gave it a symbolic, sort of idealized representation beyond our real life mother. Or maybe there were other words for other qualities based on the animals with whom our lives were so intimately intertwined, right? The courage of the lion, the strength of the elephant, the wisdom of the owl, the trickiness of the fox or the coyote. And we told stories about these characters to our children. Right? The great Lakota Sioux elder and shaman Lame Deer said this: "We Sioux spend a lot of time thinking about everyday things. We see around us many symbols that teach us the meaning of life. We have a saying that the white man sees so little, he must see with only one eye. See a lot that you no longer notice. You could notice it if you wanted to, but you're usually too busy. We Indians live in a world of symbols and images where the spiritual and the commonplace are one. To you, symbols are just words spoken or written in a book. To us, they are part of nature, part of ourselves. The earth, the sun, the wind, and the rain, stones, trees, animals, even little insects like ants and grasshoppers." This is the territory of childhood, it's the territory of myth, of dream, of folklore. The great political philosopher Hannah Arendt said, "Storytelling reveals meaning without committing the error of defining it." But we civilized humans like to define our terms, don't we? We began at some point to ask what qualities make a good human being, a worthwhile human life. What qualities do we most value? Probably every culture, every religion, every spiritual tradition in history has come up with a list of the top 4, 5, or 6 qualities or virtues. And often then there are the opposites, which are called vices or sins. Or in Buddhist thought, they're called the hindrances, states that obstruct, cloud our clear mind, and then distort our thoughts, speech, and actions. So that's a little less blamey to me. That's a little more freeing to see the hindrances as obstructions, as, you know, states of weather, states of inner weather that get in the way of our naturally clear view. It seems a basic component of human culture to create these categories, so that's what we do. And culture, of course, is the way we social beings pass on our ways of living from generation to generation, through language, philosophy, religion, food, technologies, arts, crafts, architecture, literature, etc. And as we lived in tribes and villages and cities and nations, we had to create shared values to help us get along with each other, right? To regulate our tendencies toward greed, aversion, and ignorance, to use the Buddhist terms of the three poisons, to keep us from causing harm and mayhem in our relationships with each other, individually and collectively. So then we ask, are there universal values, universal virtues that we find in every culture? Or are there some that vary? Are there even some that come in conflict with each other? And how did these virtues get entangled with power and hierarchy and gender, race, and more? How did that happen? How did they get entangled with blame and shame? How did they become clubs to wield against each other? Even in subtle ways. We can do it with our friends. Well, how come I was generous to you and you weren't generous back to me, right? So I hope we can touch on some of these questions as we dig deeper into the paramitas and learn how to cultivate them in a way that doesn't subvert them. You know, how not to layer in our competitiveness and judgment and, you know, some of the not-so-wholesome values. So I thought we could do a little very compressed world survey of virtues and see how some of these relate to the paramitas, perhaps. So in ancient Egypt, there was a single principle called ma'at, which included truth, balance, order, law, morality, and justice, all one kind of encompassing principle, which was personified as a goddess who regulated not only the stars and the seasons, but the actions of gods and humans. And Egypt was a very stable society for some thousands of years. So the word virtue comes from the Latin, vir. So virile. Vir means man. So virtues were manly qualities. And so it's a little bit unfortunate that virtue is the way that the original Greek word was translated and came to be in common use in English. The Greek word arete, A-R-E-T-E, I'm guessing on the pronunciation, is ungendered, and it has a meaning closer to excellence. So it's closer to what our understanding of paramitas is. In ancient Greece, the philosopher Plato listed the four, what came to be called the four Socratic virtues, because he felt his teacher Socrates embodied them so well. And I was quite struck by how these excellences or virtues correspond to the paramitas, so I'll just run through them. The first one's wisdom, or sophia, the ability to discern the appropriate course of action to be taken in a given situation at an appropriate time. The Canadian poet and philosopher Jan Zwicky writes about Plato and turns to Plato for guidance in a discussion of the virtues in her book, Learning to Die, Wisdom in the Age of the Climate Crisis. And she co-wrote this book with her partner, also poet, Robert Bringhurst. So she's looking at Plato for guidance in our present state of challenge, both on the personal, community, national, and global scales. And here's what she says. To possess Sophia, wisdom, is to know what's what and to act accordingly. It is to be aware. It is striking that Plato insists that Socrates' Sophia was rooted in his awareness that he did not know. This aspect of Socrates' character is best described not as ignorance, but as humility. Not in the sense of abasement or meekness, but a robust willingness to ask himself why he believes what he believes, and an equally robust refusal to regard because everyone else believes it as a good answer. This pairing of wisdom with humility, of knowing how much we don't know, of not being quite so sure that we're right all the time, really resonates with the Zen sensibility. I think most of you have heard the line from the famous Zen koan, not knowing is most intimate. Not knowing is not getting stuck in a fixed view. So the next one's fortitude, also known as courage, forbearance, strength, endurance, the ability to confront fear or to the capacity to hold uncertainty. So that one overlaps with patience, it overlaps with equanimity and energy. Next one's temperance. That's an old-fashioned word. Temperance, also known as restraint, practice of self-control, moderation, abstention, discretion. It's the quality that tempers our, I want what I want it now. Tempers thought, no matter what anybody else's needs are. Which is a very strong countervalue in our culture, isn't it? Right? Plato considered this one the most important, actually. And it can also be translated as sound-mindedness. I like that. Sound-mindedness. A kind of grounded steadiness. I like the word moderation also, because it fits with the Buddhist middle path, not going to extremes. Willingness not to pursue narrow self-interest, but to consider the greater good. So each of us might consider what that would be for us. You know? As Canadians, most of us are willing to have our right to own an automatic rifle restricted. And most of us are willing to pay taxes so that we can have universal health care. What about the discomforts and inconveniences of the COVID-19 restrictions? How do we react? How do we feel about that inside? Varies. Varies from person to person, and it varies within one person. But it's worth noting, And what restraints are we willing to take on to reduce our collective carbon debt load? What specific restraints individually, and what collectively are we willing to support and embrace for the greater good? So that all falls under this category of moderation, temperance. And there's no there's no specific quality in Buddhist thought that quite aligns with that, and yet the middle path itself does, right? Equanimity does. And then comes justice. So you don't really hear much about justice per se in Buddhist writing, traditional Buddhist writing, and yet it's there implicit in so many of the teachings. I did a couple of Dharma talks over the past year or so about justice, so I'm not going to go further. But to say that the two related issues of racial and climate justice are of such paramount importance right now in our world, and that we can find the ground for wise speech and action in response right here in the practice of the paramitas, I believe. So there are other parallels with Buddhist thought to be found in Greek philosophy. And believe me, I am no expert in Greek philosophy. This is I'm drawing on other people's work. Aristotle defined virtue as a point between a deficit and an excess of a quality. But that point is not necessarily the exact middle. It could be closer to one end or the other end of the spectrum, depending on circumstances. And that's what he called the golden mean. We've heard that expression, right? He said, he wrote, at the right times, about the right things, towards the right people, for the right end, and in the right way, is the intermediate and best condition, and this is proper to virtue, right? So, taking the first paramita of generosity, one extreme is miserliness, hoarding, and the other extreme is kind of indiscriminate giving without real consideration for one's well-being or whether that's even what the person needs, whether it's even helpful. So Aristotle is describing what is not one of the six paramitas we'll be looking at, but it's often included in a longer list, and that's skillful means or compassionate means. And it applies to all of them. We can take that back and apply it to all of them. So there are lists and lists. Michael talked about lists yesterday. There are lists and lists in various schools of philosophy, Greek, Roman, and others. And some of them are really long. So if you just take a peek in Wikipedia, you might get some ideas for some others that you haven't even thought of. The Judaic tradition bases virtue on keeping the Ten Commandments. And the distillation of virtue is the Golden Rule. The great sage and scholar Rabbi Hillel, when asked for a concise summary of the Jewish religion, said this, reputedly while standing on one leg, that which is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow. That is the whole Torah. The rest is commentary. Go and learn. So you can see why there's a kind of Jewish affinity with Zen. That could just as well have been one of those old Chinese Zen masters speaking. So then Christianity adopted those four Socratic virtues, as the cardinal virtues, and added three more, which are called the theological virtues: faith, hope, and charity, or faith, hope, and love. I don't know if there's anybody here who's old enough to remember. Do you remember Roy Rogers and Dale Evans? Okay. They sang this theme song. It went, "Have faith, hope, and charity. That's the way to live successfully. How do I know? The Bible tells me so." Can you believe that was on TV? So, faith, hope, and charity used to be feminine names. I knew a Hope when I was a kid. Along with temperance, chastity, patience. They seem so old-fashioned now. It seems even to talk of virtues seems kind of either naive or suggestive of fundamentalism to our postmodern sensibilities. It made me wonder, you know, what names, if we were to name our kids after the values of capitalist consumerism, what would we name them? And so I looked down the list of the seven deadly sins. So we have pride, superbia. We could call a kid superbia. Or envy, invidia. Gula. That's gluttony. Luxuria, lust. Ira, wrath. Avaricia, greed. And acedia, sloth. Sloth and torpor, that's one of the Buddhist hindrances, right? But it means more than laziness. It's not just simple laziness. It means a kind of apathy. You know, that sapping of energy. It's really an important one to look at and work with. And acedia is a word that's often used in Christian contemplative traditions to describe that kind of dry staleness when your practice goes stale. So these are important ones to look at. But it just struck me how the name sounded like names. And the question, you know, what are the values that are being communicated, right, in our world today? Okay, on to Islam. Here's a quote from Wahbi Sabin Mabad, who is a companion of Muhammad, speaking on virtue. "I went to the messenger of God," and that's Muhammad, "and he asked me, 'Have you come to inquire about virtue?' I replied in the affirmative. Then he said, 'Ask your heart regarding it. Virtue is that which contents the soul and comforts the heart, and sin is that which causes doubt and perturbs the heart. Even if people pronounce it lawful and give you verdicts on such matters again and again,'" little bit of a case for civil disobedience there, you know. If you consult your deepest heart, That was Muhammad. And I thought, oh, very like the Buddha's words to the people of the Kalama clan, who asked him, they said, "So many holy men are coming through our village, wandering through and teaching. How do we know? How can we tell whose teachings are valid?" And the Buddha replied, and I'll paraphrase, he said, "Don't follow based on hearsay or tradition or even scriptures or logic and analysis or because a respected teacher tells you to follow. You must put these teachings to practice. And if they lead to harm and suffering, do not follow them. And if they lead to well-being and happiness, continue to practice them." That's a little different from the Roy Rogers song. You know? The Buddha was a remarkable spiritual teacher, and empowering his disciples to use their own experience, their deepest heart, and their observation of the world around them. So, as Buddhism spread into China from India, it encountered Taoist and Confucian principles. So you've heard of the Taoist classic, the Tao Te Ching. Tao means way, pronounced Do in Japanese, so Aikido, Cha Do, all the different Do disciplines or ways. De means virtue, and Jing means record. So the Tao Te Ching is the record of the virtuous way. And the two particularly important virtues in Taoism are the qualities of Wu Wei and Su Jian. Wu Wei is often translated as non-doing. Non-doing or effortless action. And the metaphor of flowing water is often used to describe that sort of flexible capacity to respond to circumstances without being pushed or pulled, without pushing or pulling. Just a very free and spontaneous way. And then Su Jian kind of literally means self-such or self-as-it-is. And it again, it describes this kind of natural, spontaneous way of living, manifesting the being in the world, just as it is, actualizing our nature. So we can really see these influences in Zen, right? This is a sort of, this Taoist influence gave Zen a particular flavor going forward. In Taoist thought, the three treasures are compassion, moderation, and humility. So again, you see that coming up in Zen teachings. And then the three most important Confucian values are Ren, humanity, Xiao, filial piety, so duty to and loyalty to one's parents, and Li, proper behavior, behaving correctly and performing rituals correctly. So those three were also absorbed into Buddhism and transmitted to Japan and Korea, where that Confucian element is there as well. And sometimes these virtues create inner conflict or familial conflict or even national. There's subtle ways that this happens. The classic conflict in Japanese culture is between giri and ninjo. Giri is the duty or social obligation towards those who are superior to you or you are dependent upon. So your parents, your teachers, you're a samurai to his lord, a worker to the boss, an apprentice to a teacher. That's giri. It's what you owe. And ninjo is human feeling. It's your natural warmth and attachment for others, kindness, compassion. And though ninjo isn't strictly romantic love, the conflict with giri, between giri and ninjo, is central to some of the great Japanese romances and TV dramas and plays. You know, the samurai wants to marry, you know, it falls in love with a low-ranking woman, and his duty is to his lord, that sort of thing. Lots of high drama. But no matter what tradition, of any of these traditions, it's not easy to live up to our highest aspirations, is it? And those virtues can sometimes seem murky or even contradictory. How do we find the golden mean? There's so much, it seems, when you do a little survey like this, to be so much common ground in our human values. And so, if so, how do we get into so much trouble? Why can't we get along? Even with those in our own family or our next door neighbors, let alone those whom we perceive to be different from us or to hold different values. Big questions worth inquiring into. Jan Zwicky, in the book I just mentioned, suggests one key. She talks about what she calls moral ecology, which is a concept that can be as easily applied to the paramitas as to the Greek virtues that she's talking about. She says, becoming an excellent human being requires one to adopt a moral ecology. And ecologies aren't modular constructions. They don't consist of separate bricks that are snapped together or unsnapped like pieces of Lego. Moral ecologies, like biological ones, are organic wholes whose distinguishable aspects, the virtues, or we'll say the paramitas, stand in internal relationship to one another. None can be acquired without acquiring the others. So I think in the coming weeks, we're really going to see this. We're going to see how these paramitas don't stand alone, that they support each other and interact all the time. Okay, so the reason I did this sort of little whirlwind world survey is that I want you to think beyond the paramitas as Buddhist doctrine, to see that you can apply the principles and practices of this particular list of paramitas to a wide range of values and virtues. You can make your own list, as Michael suggested. As you do that, notice which ones are particularly strong for you that you really value and which ones you tend to resist, and make sure to include some of them too, you know, as sort of personal call-ons. What's going on here? And I want to encourage you not to find the virtues not just in the Dharma readings that we've suggested. And by the way, there is a reading list posted in three places, on the practice period guide and on each of the Wednesday night Dharma seminar and the Sunday morning. So you can find, it's the same list, but you can find them in three places. It's a PDF, and it'll give you a list of some really fine readings on the paramitas, and also some material about somatic work, body awareness, that Kay has put together for us, this whole list. But go beyond. Look for these questions in film or literature, arts, novel, the stories that you tell each other from your own life experience. Maybe you will create images or imaginary bodhisattvas for some particular quality or virtue that you choose. Maybe you'll write poems or stories about them. You know, consider how we learn as children growing up about values. Yeah, we learn through instruction, you know, if we go to church or maybe to some extent in school. In traditional societies, religion played a really important role. But in our secular society, educators have begun to ask that question, you know, what's missing? And have tried to find ways of including values and critical thinking and philosophy in curriculum, curricula, even for quite young children. Because even young children develop a moral sense, even very young children, by observing the world around them, learn by example what is harmful, what is nourishing, what is just, what is unjust. But we also learn, children traditionally have learned through myth and archetypes and folktales. In Japan, the bodhisattvas, particularly Kannon, the bodhisattva of compassion, and Jizo, the bodhisattva of great vow, they're beloved folk figures. You see them all over in daily life, you know. And there are countless folktales that teach these. I'm sure I'll bring some in for you over the course of that teach about generosity, say, or wisdom. And many of them also are situated, the folk, you know, the thing about folk tales that I personally rather love is that they're situated in place, right? There says, this happened here. This bodhisattva appeared to this person, and there, that rock is shaped like that bodhisattva. I think that so many of us, most of us here in North America, have come as settlers, as immigrants, whether first generation or many generations back. We left that material, that rooted in place, connected with the plants and animals and stones of a place that teach us how to be in the world. We left that, we got cut off from that, and there's a yearning in us for that, I think. And some of us kind of managed to absorb that through living close to nature, because it's natural that we do. But we learn how to be in those ways, right? But all the instruction in the world and all the religious texts in the world cannot get us to behave well without lived experience. And insight. In other words, practice. And that's what the Buddhist tradition offers us. The Buddha, having been an eminent pragmatist, he offered us a scaffolding of practices upon which to construct a well-lived and beneficial life. And these paramitas are part of that scaffolding. And they have their foundation in the very practice of our zazen, of our moment-to-moment awareness of body and mind. I was really actually quite pleased, quite excited when Kay thought of the idea of connecting the paramitas with body awareness, somatic awareness. Because I think it's so easy for people to kind of get excited about Zen and, you know, the literature, and to think, okay, I'm going to learn how to meditate. And meditating is about dealing with my thoughts, right? And my thoughts are located in my head. Like, that's where the mind is, in our head. Not true. Not true. You know, the latest neuroscience tells us that our mind is located throughout our body, and Buddhism tells us beyond our body, you know, that the mind is boundless. So we have to start by paying attention to our whole body-mind. And so, you know, we're going to, Kay's going to get us work, you know, practicing with that. And this is where the root of practicing with these qualities is there, in that direct embodied experience of letting go and in opening to letting go of our contracted, defended, separate self. And from this, our capacity to express our lives, to manifest our lives, expands. And imagination, that ability to visualize other ways of living and being beyond our contracted personal experience, is essential in this endeavor to be fully actualized human beings. So, top on our list of readings is Norman Fisher's, our teacher Norman Fisher's book, The World Could Be Otherwise, Imagination and the Bodhisattva Path. And that's the overarching theme of Norman's book, is the role of imagination. He writes, imagination expands the heart, causing us to understand others as ourselves and ourselves as not belonging to us. And then he quotes the poet Shelley, an essay called A Defense of Poetry, which says, the great secret of morals is love, a going out of ourself and an identification with others. the great instrument of moral good is the imagination. The great instrument of moral good is the imagination. So, during this practice period, we will be exercising our imagination. We will be telling and listening to stories from each other about living in this world. You know, about the paramitas, how to live an authentic life, expressing our most core values. And we include in these stories our challenges and mistakes, right? Because we're human. And we then that's, you know, I wish paramita wasn't translated as perfection, because, you know, perfectionism can be so toxic in our lives and our culture. So we'll just be calling them the paramitas, okay? David Loy, the Buddhist teacher who really talks about climate change and what he calls it, eco-sattva, or eco-Buddhism, wrote an earlier book called The World is Made of Stories. And he says the metaphorical nature of religious language makes its claims to truth the most difficult to evaluate, because we cannot agree on what criteria to use. Myth or story avoids this problem by being meaningful in a different way. Religious doctrines, like other ideologies, involve propositional claims to be accepted, right? Either take it or leave it. You believe it or you don't. He says myths provide stories to interact with. And I think that's what all the stories of the Zen koan literature are. They're stories to interact with. And so we'll probably be including some of them in the coming weeks as well. Now, sometimes you hear Dharma teachers telling you to let go of your stories, right? We should let go. They're just stories. But that's not what I'm talking about here. That's our contracted, narrow stories, habitual stories. What I'm talking about here is expanding our story. Expanding our story beyond those constricted, self-limiting stories to the boundless, endless story that allows us to take our place as humans with care alongside the myriad other beings in a world that does not belong to us but is us. Okay, one more quote. This is from Thomas Berry, the scholar of world religions, who later in life came to call himself a geologian. A geologian. He says, "The universe story is the quintessence of reality. We perceive the story. We put it in our language. We put it in our language. The birds put it in theirs, and the trees put it in theirs. We can read the story of the universe in the trees. Everything tells the story of the universe. The winds tell the story. Literally, not just imaginatively. The story has its imprint everywhere, and that is why it's so important to know the story. If you do not know the story, in a sense, you do not know yourself. You do not know anything." So maybe we can do some listening to stories that are told in different languages from our own, and they too can tell us how to be in the world. And maybe we can open up our practice of the paramitas so that we can fully inhabit our lives as part of that big, big, big story. Okay, thank you. Thank you, everyone, for being here. So great to see everyone near and far sitting nobly together this weekend. May our intention equally extend to every reading and place with the true merit of are inexhaustible. I vow to attend them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable.